Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to an episode of Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Sparky Lee, a.k.a. Lauren Strank. I am the CEO and founder of Legacy Programs Education Reentry. We pride ourselves in knowing where you've been and knowing where to send you. So we have a special guest today. His name is Sean. He will be speaking on reentry. If anybody has any questions or comments, please feel free to ask. We do not mute anybody, so we ask you to mute yourself until, you know, and we understand there's a lag, so go ahead and speak up. Don't worry about interrupting people. It's not a big deal. It's Wi-Fi, right? So other than that, happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there right now. And let's not take for granted or forget about the ones that are behind the walls still being a parent and still doing what they're supposed to. This is a very huge shout out to the fathers behind the walls and especially to the moms that are the dads as well. Growing up as without my father, I understand that, you know, sometimes a mother has two roles to play, and we just want to really celebrate you as well today, or a dad. Sometimes it's just, the role you play, especially out, to the stepdads out there. It's rough, but it's a meaningful job that needs to be done. And so huge shout out to you as well. And then other than that, if anyone wants to check us out, legacyprograms.net. We're also still looking for donations to keep the radio show going at NVO on Cash App. Just check it out online. You know, we're always looking for help. And also our reentry program to help send clothes, hygiene, the necessities to keep people out, and feeling like a human being. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to you, Sean.
Well, I appreciate that, Sparky. And you know what? I like the way you started that off, because we kind of tend to forget. Well, we don't forget because we've been in there, but a lot of people tend to forget that. And you're sitting there as a kid, and you can't celebrate the day with your father because your father's incarcerated. If you're lucky, you get a little phone call limited to 15 minutes, interrupted every 5 minutes or so with some message about it being monitored, recorded. Which, of course, means that your father is unable to do or say the things that he wants to do to express his feelings, because he knows that everything he's doing is somehow being used against him. So you're right that we should actually take a moment to think about that, because there's a lot of people in prison that they're fathers, but they really want to take care of their kids, and they can't because of where they're at. There's all these rules, there's all these regulations, these limitations on what they can and cannot do. You go to get a visit with your dad, you're allowed one hug, one kiss at the beginning of the visit, one hug, one kiss at the end of the visit. That's it. You can't sit on your dad's lap, you know, have him read you a story. You can't sit there holding his hand. You know, you're technically not allowed to do any of that. And it's a really, really harsh way of punishing somebody, because we tend to forget that it's not just the father who's being punished. The kids are punished too. The mother's being punished. Everybody is suffering for what happened, for what the father did. And we talk about impact of our actions and how we learn and progress and everything else. Well, this would be a really good example, because we don't really think about that when we go out to do the things that we did. And again, that's why I like the way you started off the show. So to all the dads that are in prison, you're not forgotten. So we were talking about reentry and everything else, Sparky and I, before the show started, and the different things that need to be done. And having traveled down that path, I could say that there really are not a lot of programs out there for somebody just getting out of prison. And the programs that do exist have so many rules and regulations, so many restrictions on them, that they're pretty much meaningless. I was fortunate because I had somebody willing to bring up a travel trailer and donate it to me or let me use it while I'm going through this process. And that made my bills a lot cheaper, because a lot of these things we take for granted, first month's rent, last month's rent, security deposit. How does a person get this? How do they save up for this when they're making, you know, at most $1 an hour, out of which CDC takes 55%. It's really impossible. And then you figure that once you start making money in CDC, you have to pay for your own envelopes, your own stamps. And we were just talking about Father's Day. So an individual who's trying to be a father to his kid is going to be sitting there sending letters home to his loved ones and everything else. That is a very hefty expense when you're only making $1 an hour. And that, by the way, is the most you can make in CDC, and that is only if you have a job with PIA. The average person that has a job in CDC does not make any money whatsoever, not 1 cent. If they work directly for CDC, I think it's $40 a month, just depending upon the job that they have. At the end of the day, it's not much money. So when you get out of prison, you are, for all intents and purposes, flat broke. So you come out, if you're lucky, you have a counselor who has helped you get set up with your Medi-Cal and other little things like that, so you can come up and at least have your medical insurance covered. During the height of the COVID pandemic, you were supposed to get a 90-day supply of medication. I wasn't that fortunate. I was released with a 2-week supply of medication just because the facility I was in just didn't want to give me my medication. It was so expensive. So you get out, and what do? Well, I got lucky. As I said earlier, I had somebody that was willing to donate the travel trailer. Most people don't have that opportunity. So how do you go about finding a place to live? How do you go about getting that first month, last month, and everything else? I talked to social services, and they have a program called GR, which is a loan. It's not a gift. It is not a grant. You have to pay the money back. If you are eligible for GR, you can get, I believe it's $132 a month as a regular individual. $132 a month doesn't pay for anything. If you have a place to stay, they're willing to give you up to $300 a month towards the rent, but the rent has to be no higher than $300 a month or they will not give it to you. I don't know of any place that I can rent for $300 a month. The least expensive place that I have ever found so far was $325 a month, and that was for a parking lot, a space to park my trailer in a parking lot. My parole officer did not approve it, but that was still the cheapest place that I found. So there's all of these different things that you have to take into account. And again, these programs take a lot of time to apply for. One of the programs that I applied for, I believe was HOPWA, H-O-P-W-A, was supposed to help keep me from going homeless. I went through the whole process, got everything set up. At the very last second, they stepped in and said, we are not going to help you because you live in a travel trailer. Well, I have a firm philosophy, which is simply this. If you cannot afford somebody, you have two choices. You can default or you can downsize. I chose to downsize. I chose to go with the travel trailer. Excuse me. And I did that because I knew that I could not afford first month's rent, last month's rent, security deposit, and everything else. I knew that my chances for success on parole were very, very closely related to not living outside my needs. So when they stepped in to decide not to pay not to help me with the rent at the very last second, they kind of threw me in a lurch. And again, I tell these stories not because I'm trying to make somebody feel sorry for what I'm going through. I tell the stories because I want the individual who's listening to this to understand just how difficult it is to make it on parole. They did a study a while back. They took a bunch of prosecutors and put them in a gym, and inside the gym there were a bunch of tables, and each table was set up for a specific thing. One table was DMV, one table was Social Security for your Social Security cards, another was Social Security disability, so on and so forth. The goal here was that these individuals, these prosecutors, had to do the exact same things that we had to do upon getting out. And they had one day to do it, one day meaning like 8 hours or whatever it was that they were in there for. So they had to go, and, you know, the guy goes up to the DMV and says, I need a copy of my driver's license. You have a Social Security card, birth certificate, so on and so forth. No, I don't. So he's bouncing around from table to table trying to get what he needs in order to get his driver's license. And at the end of the day, nobody was able to do it. It was that difficult. Well, imagine that for a second. If it's that difficult to sit there and do all of this stuff in one room that has everything that you need, and now admittedly it's a simulation, but that's not the point. If you can't do it in that one room, imagine how difficult it is for a guy getting out of prison and trying to do all of that with no transportation, going from one end of town to the next. I went to my parole officer and I asked for bus passes, and I was told no. The bus passes are only for parole type appointments. You know, when you're going to your parole office, when you're going to your treatment meetings, and so on and so forth. So I had to walk. Now, I had a broken knee, recovery from a broken knee, so my situation is a little bit more difficult, but it's still difficult when you're walking from one end of town to the next. And I can only imagine how difficult it is in a large town. I live in a small town. So all of these things that we go through, people sit there and they don't understand, well, why can't you make it on parole? Why are you getting violated? Now, I haven't been violated, and I pray, knock on wood, that I don't get violated. But the fact of the matter is that difficulties arise not because the parolee wants to go out there and screw up, not because the parolee is an idiot or anything like that, and certainly not because he doesn't care about going back to prison. Trust me, we care. We don't want to go back to prison. The difficulties arise because the situation that we've been thrust in, we were put into the situation with absolutely no preparation. What should have happened is individuals in custody should be provided with, at no expense to them, things like your necessities, your birth certificate, your Social Security card. Like, these are the things that should be given. Now, I can just imagine that at some point in time, someone listening to this is going to sit there and say, well, wait a minute, we give you a state identification. Yes and no. You are eligible to get certain state identifications, driver's license, identification card, et cetera, but only if you have been in custody for less than 10 years. If you've been in custody less for over 10 years, or if your picture is over 10 years, they will not give you a copy of your identification. As far as Social Security card and birth certificate is concerned, I had to jump through hoops to get this kind of stuff. I fought for years to get this kind of stuff, and it wasn't until I went to the county jail after my incarceration, while I was waiting to be released, it wasn't until then that somebody stepped in and helped me get my Social Security card. Again, I was in a better situation than the average person when I got out on parole because I had my birth certificate, I had my Social Security card, I had those important documents, so I was able to go get my birth certificate or my driver's license. But again, these issues are issues that the average person faces on a daily basis when it comes to parole. Another thing that we were talking about is another reason why the recidivism rate is so high. You take a guy who, for whatever reason, he's in a gang, and he goes to prison. He has an epiphany more often than not when he steps into that jail cell. And he realizes, you know what, this is not the life for me. This is not what I want to be doing. I don't want to be in prison. I don't want to be coming back. But how does he get out of it? Now, the average person sits there and says, oh, they just don't commit any more crimes. Well, that's easier said than done, because in a gang, you don't really have too much of an option in what you're doing. You're just like being in prison, things are dictated to you. Yes, you can tell them no, but everything has a consequence. A lot of these guys that are in prison want to drop out of the gang. I know this from personal experience. I've talked to these guys over and over and over again, and the consensus among many of them is I really don't want to be in this gang, but I can't drop out, because if I drop out, they're going to kill me. So they sit there and they do their time, and they continue to be in the gang. They have a perfect opportunity to drop out, but they don't, because they know when it's all said, done, and over with, going to be sent back home. And when they go back home to the same neighborhood that they grew up in, you can't run from anything. Like, everybody knows you. Everybody knows where you're at. That's a wrap. So we have this rule in Title 15, which is part of the California Code of Regulations pertaining to parolees, inmates, et cetera. And this rule says that you have to parole to the county commitment, the last county of legal residence. Well, knowing that, why would you send somebody right back to the environment that you know that they cannot handle? And those who have been in the system already know the answer. Those who haven't been in the system, they don't understand the answer to that. So the matter is, they send you back to where you were because it's guaranteed to fail. They want you to return. They want you to come back. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And they know that if you go back to that same environment, your chances of returning are exponentially increased. So these are some of the issues that your average bully experiences. Now, from time to time, you'll find that rare success story. And when you do, you'll realize that success story was a success story, is a success story, because of the people that got involved. Take my situation, for instance. I got out April 28th, 2022. It's not even been 2 months, and I can honestly say that as of like last week, as of Friday, I believe it was, I am self-sufficient. I am now making enough money to pay my meager little bills. Now, my bills aren't all that much, but, you know, it is what it is. This was a lot of work, a lot of hard work in the making, but I got it. But I only was able to do this because of my landlord. My landlord, bless his heart, facilities to me. He rented to me knowing my situation, knowing I was on parole, knowing the difficulties that came along with it and everything else. That was a big deal to me. Not only that, he offered me a job, and he did so, once again, knowing the situation I was going to be dealing with. He dealt with my parole officer. He didn't take any crap from my parole officer. He did everything that a person could ask of him in order to get me the job. When I got the job, he bent over backwards to make sure that I was able to make my appointments and everything else. And think about that for a second. You're on parole. You're required to go to these meetings. You're required to see your parole officer. You're required to do all of these different things, registration, whatever it is that you have to do. And these things, as a general rule, you don't have, you know, a couple of weeks notice. The other day, my parole officer came to me and says, okay, on Wednesday, we need you for a containment team meeting at 10 o'clock in the morning. Okay, we'll reschedule it because I want my support personnel. Nope, we can't reschedule it. So with literally just a few days to prepare, if I had a regular job, I probably would have lost that job because most bosses are not understanding. Most bosses are not going to sit there and say, oh, yeah, go ahead and take the day off work. They hired you to do a certain job at a certain time in a certain way. That's their money. They have that right. You don't show up, you lose the job. Again, I got lucky because my landlord, my boss, was sitting there saying, hey, we're going to go ahead and I'm going to work with you. I'm going to let you go ahead and do what you need to do. I said all of that because I want the listeners to understand when I say it takes a village, it takes a village. It takes, when you have all these, the success stories, you realize that all of these different people were there to help this person make that transition. Now, on the one hand, I get it. Making that it's the parolee's responsibility. He's the one who broke the law. He's the one that messed up everything else. It's his responsibility to make that transition. You're 100% right. But at the same time, our system is set up in such a way to where it is physically impossible to make that transition successfully without some sort of help from individuals that have the ability and the capability to help out. So the next time that you're dealing with a parolee or dealing with anybody, you know, just take that into consideration because the little thing, it's the little things you do that make the biggest difference in somebody's life. Now, this guy, he knew he was going to get his money. It wasn't an issue of, will I get my money? It was an issue of he, you know, bent some of his rules. They were his rules. They weren't, you know, laws or anything else. They were just his rules of conduct that he has for this facility. And he allowed me to move in with a trailer that was more than 10 years old. The trailer is actually from 1986. It's pretty old. It's not decrepit, but it's definitely seen better days. The paint's faded and everything else. Not the image he wanted to present, but he decided to give me that opportunity. And I now work for the guy. And it was beneficial for both of us. It's beneficial for me because I got a place to stay. I got an understanding boss and everything else. It's beneficial to him because having shown me that kindness, having welcomed me the way that he did, he's earned loyalty from me in a way that I can't even begin to explain. And I don't know how most people feel about loyalty, but to me, loyalty is a pretty big thing. So when it comes to reentry, It's definitely not an I thing. It's definitely a team thing. The more people that can get involved, the more people that can find out about the different programs that are out there and they can help out, the better it is. Sadly, it doesn't really work that well because programs that do exist are usually shut down to people in my situation. There is somebody who's listening. Sparky knows who it is. I don't know if they want me to put their name out there, so I won't. But she actually got involved on my behalf trying to help me out. And she sent out a massive amount of emails to different people trying to get me into these programs and everything else. And for some reason, which she cannot figure out, nobody's responding. Nobody wants to help out. Nobody wants anything to do with the situation. They're just not answering emails. And she made a comment the other day to the effect of, in all her time of helping people out, she's never seen this. And to be fair, she doesn't, her role isn't someone who helps parolees out. Her role is just is somebody who works in social services, helping out people in general. So it's a very difficult time, made even more difficult by individuals who have the ability to help out, who use that authority in a way to deny assistance to those who need it. Just a quick little update on my situation. So in July of last year, I slipped in the county jail. I fell and I snapped my kneecap in half. The jail refused to pay some of my medical bills. They won't use the word refuse. They just say, oh, we haven't done it yet. And they refused to pay any future medical bills. So I filed a lawsuit. I went to court. According to the opposition, I was a prisoner, and therefore they're immune. They can do whatever they want, and there's nothing I can say one way or the other. My argument, as those of you who know and are familiar with the case, is that as a civil detainee, I was not a criminal detainee, I was a civil detainee. I am not a prisoner under the meaning of law, and therefore you are not immune. The judge didn't even, care what I had to, I felt the judge didn't care what I had to say, and he sustained their demur without legal men, and then they had the nerve to sit there and try to ask for payment for legal expenses. Again, these are the things that we deal with on a regular basis from being in custody. Child support, they sit there, they make mistakes on your record, and then you're the one who has to pay for it to fix it. They openly admit to having made a mistake and sent a notice out to cancel my license. But yet I'm the one who has to pay the fee to get it reinstated. They openly admit that for 8 months they reported me as not making payments, even though there weren't any payments due. But yet I'm the one who has to go fix the credit. And again, these are the things that your average parolee has to deal with when he gets out of custody. And yes, that is a real thing. We get out and we find out. I was proactive. I actually wrote letters to child support and everything else to get this taken care of prior to my release. I got my credit fixed while I was in custody because I was there for so long, 19 years. So my credit was all fixed before I got out. Once it was fixed, I seen no reason to monitor it anymore, which was probably my mistake because now I find out that they went and did this behind my back. The average person doesn't do that for whatever reason, and they get out, and they have all of these things showing up on their credit. This prevents you from getting a place to live. This prevents you from getting a credit card. All of these different things that we take for granted that the average parolee is unable to do, which means they cannot participate in society. So at this moment, if there's anybody who's listening, has any questions whatsoever, as Sparky said at the beginning of the show, feel free to jump in. I can't see you. You can't see me. So if you're sitting here waiting on me to pause, I have no idea that you're doing so. I'm not going to be offended if you cut me off. And I actually enjoy the back and forth dialogue. I enjoy the questions when somebody says, well, what was it like here? Or how did you do this? Or how did you overcome that? My hope is that there are other parolees out there listening to my story and who are sitting here saying, hey, dude, I'm having a problem with X, Y, and Z. How do I overcome this? What can I do to get past this hurdle? That's what we want to do. We want to shed light on the issues that we're having and use this as a teaching opportunity to help other people, because why should you have to make the same mistake that I did? Why can't you learn from my mistakes? So, again, if you got questions, feel free to ask. In the meantime, I'm just going to keep on talking in the hopes that I say something that resonates with somebody. So I had my first containment team meeting this week. Sparky, this is this process is kind of a joke. I have a friend, Robin. She says shame is not a treatment model, and I think someone needs to share that with parole, because whenever we deal with parole, I swear these people they want to browbeat you and shame you into submission. I spent 19 years in prison. I don't need anybody trying to browbeat or shame me. I've been going through that for 19 years. But yet that's, for some reason, they seem to think that this is magically going to, you know, make somebody stop from getting into trouble again. It was a challenge, to say the least. I went in there, and all I heard these people do was question my decisions, you know, in a very judgmental fashion, berate me and whatnot. And, you know, I sat there, I dealt with it, I maintained my composure. And when it was all said, done, and over, I left the meeting. They're still, I don't want to say they're insisting on me to move, because they haven't actually used the words, you have until X, Y, and Z to move, but they made it very clear that I can't be where I'm at, that I need to move, even though they were the ones that approved the location. Again, these issues are not unique to me. These are the things that the average person deals with going through these situations. I've seen guys get out and get a place to stay, and they're doing really, really good. And then the parole officer come by and say, you know what, we don't want you living here because there's a kid that lives next door, because, you know, whatever the case may be. There's just a lot of things going on in period right now that make it difficult as you go to make this transition. And again, this is in no way, shape, or form limited to just one case. This is across the board. I'm sitting there and I'm watching these parolees come in and out of their meeting with the parole officer, and they're all struggling. They're all having a difficult time. And they were doing this before gas went to 7 something a gallon. And it's just infinitely, what we need to do is figure out how we could come up with a better program to help these individuals make that transition from, you know, a very lengthy incarceration for a lot of these guys to life in the free world. I personally think that it starts with the parole officer. Now, you have some parole officers that actually take an active interest in what's going on, make suggestions, give you programs, et cetera, et cetera. You have other ones that just don't care one way or the other, can't be bothered. I was fortunate in some aspects. My parole officer, at least he took the time to give me a list of resources that I could contact. Unfortunately, they weren't anything that could help me. What's really difficult is when you get a parole officer who just doesn't care. And that is also a stumbling block, because if that individual, he or she, in theory, has the experience, has been doing this for a while, knows who they're dealing with, knows who they're working with, and should be able to pass you off to somebody who can help you get whatever it is that you need. It doesn't always work that way. In fact, that's why we have the problems, is because it doesn't work that way.
Hey, Sean.
Can I ask a question, please? Yes.
Hey, so a lot of times the parolees are unaware of the active duty that the parole officers are doing, to where when you get out of prison, they want to see if you're going to be a lump on a log, if you're going to be a fighter, if you're going to be a person that basically the tools are in front of you. Are you going to pick them up, or are you going to let them sit there, you know, and allow them to rust? Or are you going to put them to work and try to, you know, put them to use and do something? Because that's what a lot of times parole officers will do. For the most majority of the state of California, they try to see if you're going to be an active person, you know. And a lot of times these people, they come out and they expect things to be handed to them because they missed out on so much. Where they've, like you said last week, filet mignon, you know, you've never had something like that. And to you, that's like, you know, It's almost like going to Disneyland. It's a celebration that you've never acquired as a child, you know, but yet now as an adult, you look at it and you're like, wow, this is amazing. Where did this come from? Where is this? You know, what is that? And your curiosity isn't just curiosity. It's information that's basically obtained to you that as a parolee, if you don't ask questions, if you don't open up, try to figure things out, then a parole officer is just going to wash you up and step over you and move on. They have no business with you. They have no business. You know, as my brother always says, he told me something a long time ago, and it woke me up tremendously. I never thought my older brother Lawrence could actually educate me in something that would do me poetic justice. And I always thought I knew it all. I thought I had it all together and everything right. But then this guy comes out of prison telling me, you're married. You have no business being over there. You have, if you have no business being there, then you have no reason to be there. And I thought about it for a minute, and I mean, I was already heated. But I just smiled because my brother freaking educated me. Like, I went to a bar and I got sauced and got drugged and almost woke up with a balloon in my butt. Now, for those who don't know, I'm not an average person to step out of, you know, of my comfort zone and just go into a bar. But, you know, my brother gave me some insight. I had no business being there. I had no reason to be there. And that's another thing that, you know, I wanted to emphasize on is that when a parole officer gives you the tools of knowledge and it comes down to you of your life of going back to prison or your education or your knowledge, if a mouth doesn't open, it can't be fed. So it is solely up to you. If you feel like as a parolee that you're not getting fair treatment or you're not getting the necessities that you feel like you're desired or required for that matter, it's because you're not opening up. You're shutting down, you're closing off, and you're not allowing yourself to start over. You're holding yourself at guilt, you're holding yourself at bay, and you're going to continue to step in the same crap every single day until you open up your eyes and pick up those tools and put them to use. Like everybody, I tell them, you can go to college. It doesn't, like I tell you, it doesn't matter what you've done in your past. Believe me what I tell you. It takes time to have that water of that pond clear, but eventually it's going to be clear. And Sean, whenever, you know, as you came on, you know, weeks ago, man, you gave me insight and knowledge, and I've never stepped a foot in a prison. I always wondered what it was like, but my brother always told me I'd never survive. So I never stepped over that threshold and said, okay, let's try it. But I've been to jail many times. I don't like it. I don't like the smell of it. I don't like the taste of the food. It's the same damn treatment as the way they treat you, probably worse than prison, except they don't have, you know, blanket parties and shit like that. And, you know, and confinements of where you're, you know, you just put in a pot of where you're going to go and hope to God that you get back out, but and don't get lost in the system. But, you know, back to your story, Sean, you give a lot of insight to everything that you say. You've done this through the threshold so many times for many years. You've, like, served your country in a way. And I mean that slightly as an education, that you're able to educate other people and in such a mannerism that they should, you know, people should be able to understand. And a lot of times they're not going to be able to. But I really I hope one day, I know it's kind of weird, but I hope one day that I can meet you somehow, some way. And, you know, I don't judge a book by its cover. I don't care what you've done or what you did or where you've been or the things you've said or the things you've done. It's none of my business. Everyone's done things, whether they've gotten caught or not, whether they've gotten held up on it or not, they want to admit it or not. It doesn't matter. What's in the dark will come to light. And never hold yourself at bay because of the characteristics that you've done. There's always a reason for this season, right? And I really applaud you. I really do. I don't care what you've done. I really think that this shit is pretty childish when it comes to living life, that people make mistakes and that you can go forward. You can move on, but it does take time. It does take time to clean the blood off the hands, to clear your name, to move a status, because I've done it. And it isn't easy.
Well,
for every 10 years, it takes another 10 years. It takes another 10 years after that. And it's no easy task because people hold you at certain standards. They hold you at a liability that they think that, oh, well, you know, I'm going to live my life and I'm going to live your life as well. And until you walk in someone's shoes, I don't think that's true. I think that everybody has been places and done things for a reason. That just because they haven't done it or they haven't been there or been caught doesn't mean one day they'll wake up and they step in some shit and don't realize how to identify it. But it takes special individuals like you two that are on this show that take your time out of your day, out of your life, and say, hey, I'm not that busy. I could educate somebody. I could tell them, you know, the do's and don'ts and everything and in between. But again, it's up to them whether they want to pick up those tools and utilize them. And just because it's a, you know, it's a fork or it's a spoon, you still use it as a spork. I mean, how many times did you eat in there and you never use a utensil, you know? And they're talking about...
Well, let me point something out real quick. First, I just want to clarify, when you were talking about Prolos, or, you know, he gives you the tools and it's up to you to use them, it's not quite that easy. See, the Prolos doesn't give you those tools. What he gives you is, if you're lucky, there's a pre-generated, you know, list of housing resources, for instance. Like, you can contact these places to get assistance with housing. But as I said at the beginning of the show, 9 times out of 10, when you go to contact those places, you cannot get assistance because there's always that loophole. For instance, we've all heard of Section 8, HUD, you know, so on and so forth. Well, what most people don't know is if you have certain felonies on your record, you are automatically disqualified for life. You can never, ever, ever apply for some of those programs. And that goes not just for Section 8 and HUD. That goes for, you know, food stamps, GR, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's not necessarily a situation of the guy doesn't want to take advantage of the resources. It's more of a situation the guy doesn't know what resources are available, and those that are available, he or she cannot apply for. As far as me taking out my time, dude, I do this for a number of reasons. In a 12-step program that I participated in, which is a standard 12-step program for any addiction, we believe in making amends. Now, sometimes I can't make amends directly because if I try to make amends directly, I'm going to continue to cause harm, which defeats them. So we believe in making amends indirectly. So my sitting here talking is my way of trying to make indirect amends. If I can help one person today, if I can have one person listen to what I have to say, and because of the information that I share, because of the way that I talk to them, because of the message, for whatever reason, if that person is able to sit there and say, you know what, I'm not going to go out there and do what I was going to do because this person gave me hope, then I have accomplished my purpose. You know, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. We do this, you know, trust me, I don't do this to hear myself talk. I sit here and I talk and I'm like, oh my God, like, what do I say next? Like, you got to come up with a whole hour of diarrhea at the mouth, you know?
Right.
And it's a lot harder than it sounds. but I do it because it's my genuine hope, such as yourself, people that, like these other listeners. Somebody sits there, and a seed that I plant grows, and that person is helped in some way, shape, or form by what it is I have to say. When I said it takes a village, I meant that quite literally, you know, and by the village, I'm a part of the village now. I am a member of society. It is my responsibility. It is, think about that for a second. It is my responsibility to use my knowledge to improve my living situation. My living situation is not just going from a trailer to an apartment to a house to a mansion. My living situation is my neighbor. If you are my neighbor and you are doing bad, is it not my responsibility to do what I can to help improve your life, knowing that by improving your life, improve mine? Think about it like this. My boss has a house. He owns like half this neighborhood. He has a house on the corner, and he just bought it. It's really messed up, but he's putting work into it. And as he's doing so, he's sitting there saying, my neighbor, because we had this conversation yesterday, he said, my neighbor has his car, and it is just an eyesore. It is a blight on the neighborhood. I'm going to go offer my neighbor money to buy this car, which doesn't run, just so I can haul it off, because and I'm going to offer to paint his house. He's not going to charge the guy. He's going to offer to paint the guy's house because in painting his house and getting rid of this eyesore of a car, he has improved not only the quality of my neighbor's life, but also the quality of and the quality of the neighborhood in general. In other words, by doing something that serves a self-fulfilling or a self-serving purpose, i.e. purchasing the car and demolishing it, getting it out of there, painting the neighbor's house, he has improved the very community he lives in. The same thing applies here. You and I talking, Joe, when he chimed in the other day, a couple weeks ago, all of these conversations help improve the community. Joe brought some things up that I hadn't really considered. He brought some things up that made me sit there and go back and try to think and come up with solutions. You know, these are the types of things, these are the reasons that I do what I do, because I want to make my community a better, safer place. I don't know very, very few people that actually go out there and commit a crime because they enjoy committing crime. Yes, I know of people that have committed crimes and they get caught up in the heat of the moment and they get all excited and they talk about it. But the fact of the matter is, they didn't go rob the store. They didn't go do whatever it was they did because they enjoyed committing crime. They did what they did because it was easier for them and quicker than the alternative, which was going out there and getting a job or kicking the drug habit or whatever the case may be. So if I can make my neighborhood a better place by speaking, you know, hey, I'll do that every chance that I get. And Sparky was kind enough to invite me on this to do just that. But again, you know, sadly, these resources are not as available as you think they are. The ones that work usually come from what we're doing right now, having an open and honest discussion in which people get together and they network and they say, oh, yeah, I heard about this resource here. For instance, in the county that I live in, we have and I think this is all in California, there's 211. So if you call 211, you can usually get a lot of help on a lot of different things. You might not be able to get one person to do everything, but you can find different little organizations to step forward to help you out with small things here and there. I had a program called, I believe it was called Homebound Delivery, that came up and dropped off some food for me. Now, I could have went down to the pantry and picked it up had I had transportation, but I don't. I'm recovering from a broken knee. My only transportation is the bus, which is a mile away, and a bicycle to get to the bus. There's not really too much of a way I can put everything on a bicycle and bring it home. So these people were kind enough to bring me a little bit of food. There's another program out there that I think it's called the Redwood Community Action Agency or something to that effect, and they offer help with electricity. They offer help with propane and so on and so forth. And with gas prices the way that it is nowadays, you know, that's a very important thing. So we get here and we talk and we share these little resources with each other. You know, go to social services is a really good place for picking up resources. And to any parolee, there are two places that you can go to, three places you can go to for resources. The first one, as I just said, is 211. 211, and they'll give you the information that you need more often than not. Unfortunately, they don't know all of the different programs that are out there, and they're not able to help in all of the different ways that you might want help. That's where you go to social services, and you go to the parole department. But when you go up there, you're not looking to talk to the people that actually run the programs. Talk to the people who are there getting help. A person who is there getting help can sit there and tell you from personal experience not only what programs that they're aware of, they won't know all of them, but they'll know the ones that help them. Equally, and perhaps more importantly, they will be able to sit there and tell you which of these programs and why the programs that did not work did not work. For instance, somebody might sit there and say, well, when I went up there, like for me, I can tell you right now the reason why Hot Foot did not work for me, I made the mistake of telling them that I lived in a tribal trailer. I can pass that information on to somebody else, and when they go to do whatever it is that they do, instead of saying, I live in Space 35, they can sit there and say, I live in Unit 35. It's not a lie, not even a white lie. You live in Unit 35. But it's all in the presentation of the wording, which makes the big difference on the application. These are the kinds of things that you can learn from the people that are going through the different, that are willing to help them out. So I think at the end of the day, that's probably the most important information that I can give to you is if you're trying to get help, you know, don't necessarily confine yourself to asking the people who run the programs. First of all, they might not know everything that's out there. Second of all, if you did or said something that they disagree with or whatever, they may not be willing to help you out. So when you go to do what you do, ask the people who are there trying to get help. Did you have any other questions? You know, I'm here to answer questions. If you do, please chime in. Trying to fill time until the end of the program, and when you ask questions, it helps me, because if you're asking a question, there's a pretty good chance somebody else out there has the same question. So if I can help you out or somebody else out, I certainly will. One of the things that we don't really utilize the way that we should are the parolee appeal process. We may not be in custody anymore, but we still have the right to file an appeal. That is often a lot easier said than done, however, due to the fact that when you're doing it this way, you have to mail it in, snail mail, and everything that goes along with it. But still, my recommendation, anybody going through a problem of parole, utilize the appeals process. It is worth the effort. If nothing else, you get it on paper. And as the old saying goes, if it's not in writing, it doesn't exist.
Right.
Personally speaking, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing with you, because that was always the case with my situation, is that I never had a hard copy of anything. I never had a paper. You know, it was always, there's a number, there's information. They give you a number, you go to leave, and you go to call it, and it's disconnected, or it's never been in service, or the number they gave you was one digit off. And, you know, this information that, you know, the resource is giving you is a lot of times it's all washed up. It's all worn out. It's like a blue pair of jeans that aren't fresh anymore. They've been so worn that you just go to touch it and it rips, you know?
You know what you do in that situation?
You recycle the damn thing.
No. With the cell phones comes the ability to text. So when you ask for a number, I have a rule. If I can ask for it in writing from my probation or my parole officer, I will. And the reason I do is because the writing protects me. So, for instance, my situation where I'm living, I was trying to get a place over on 3rd Street. Originally told me it was fine, but then he looked at it. He goes, no, no, you can't get in there. Well, he told me before I moved in. So then he says, there are two places I can guarantee that are in compliance. And he gave me those two places. He said this in a text message. It is in writing from his phone number to my phone number. So now when he sits there and he says, oh, you got to move because you're not in compliance, I can sit there and say, no, 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 buddy. You told me in writing this place was guaranteed. I moved here. I spent several thousand dollars moving here. I brought this trailer up and everything else and put it here. I spent every penny I had doing this, and now you're telling me it's not okay? I am protected because it's in writing. So my suggestion to you and to anybody listening, you're having a verbal conversation, and he tells you something, follow it up. You know, Mr. Parole Officer, I just wanted to confirm with you that you wanted me to call such and such at this number on this date and this time in regards to this and see what they say. In a situation like that, and you're probably sitting there saying, well, if they don't answer the text, they're just going to sit there and say, well, I never gave you the information. I didn't answer the text. Their failure to respond to the text is an indication as well. And anybody who looks at it is going to say, well, you didn't respond to it. The reason you don't respond is because the information was correct. So that's in your favor as well. But, yeah, put it in writing. Like 100% of the time, put it in writing. Emails and everything else, they give you the opportunity to do just that. I don't yet have that ability to use email because my parole officer has really interpreted the terms, conditions.
So you're not able to use it. You're not able to access it, but is it a crime against you if a third party as myself entered it for you?
I have people do that on a regular basis. Just for that reason.
So,
and no, it is
perfect.
Not.
There's ways. Okay, there's ways around a parole officer, and I am so inclined
Let's say that different. Let's say that differently. It's not there are ways around a parole officer. It's there are ways to overcome the obstacles put in my way without violating the rule. Because when you say there are ways around the parole officer, to anybody who's listening, that implies that I'm pulling a fast one. I'm not pulling a fast one.
Well,
we're not talking.
We
about
call it wiggling. that's what I prefer. You know, it's like the guy in prison. You know, in prison, I got to do whatever I wanted because I carried around a Mac Rep folder, and I had special privileges other than the regular population. So, you know, sometimes the wiggling is necessary. And Sean, you're absolutely right. Tommy, you're absolutely right. But the thing is that we try to use, if they tell me, no, I can't do it, it's usually because of the question I ask. So now I have to ask the question differently. Yes.
Hey, Sparky, I apologize. I'm going to have to cut this short. My boss needs me out front. I really genuinely enjoyed the process, you guys. Normally I can go the whole time, but this is our busy season and we got a bunch of people coming in right now where I live at. But I sincerely appreciate the opportunity. And if anybody wants to help me out, simply go to GoFundMe.com and look up Sean, S-H-A-W-N, Perot, P-E-R-R-O-T. I do have a GoFundMe out there that's just trying to get a little bit of help. As always, it was a pleasure, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Sparky.
Always, man. You're doing a great job. Keep doing what you're doing. Thank you so much. And Leona just texted me and said that it was an awesome show. Bringing awareness, and it was a much-needed topic. So thank you so much for your contribution.
Thank you. You have a good day.
Thank you, Leona. All right, Sean.
All right, brother. Have a good one.
Hey, Lawrence.
So
keep your head. I appreciate you.
Always. So we have about 4 minutes left on the show. Like I said, you know, a couple weeks ago, I've been trying to get other people involved because – look, I don't even like the sound of my own voice. And, you know, sometimes it just sounds like a broken record. And, you know, when we hear from different perspectives, it's very important. So we can get all sides of the spectrum. And so I really encourage if anybody wants to come on here and share your story, share your experiences, please do. And I want to give a special shout out to the listeners today. Thank you so much. couldn't do it without you. For all the people that post my stuff on Facebook and comment on it and give that like or that heart, I so much appreciate it. We all appreciate it. And, you know, mass incarceration is a pandemic. It really is, and it's going unnoticed. So, you know, we need to go forward, be fearless, be bold, be brave, and just not care about what people are thinking. So thank you so much, Sean, for, you know, your sacrifice and your contribution and just all your education that you bestow upon the listeners. And, you know, we are nationwide. So, you know, there's a lot of people going, well, what the hell's going on? You know, and they hear all these stories about America and the United States and California and stuff like that. And but they really don't know. And this is something that we need to push forward head on rather than from the side anymore. So, and a special announcement, Legacy Programs Education Reentry is in the review stage to be introduced in CDCR. My curriculum, my program, everything that I've put forth this last year and a half, I'm so grateful for the support that I get from all my family, my friends, and my support network. Thank you so much, and especially for the associates that have helped me shape Legacy how it is, and the family that's been behind me to make it what I'm doing today. And I really do love advocacy, and I just can't wait until I get that final where they're just sitting there saying, come on in. And the greatest thing about going into a prison is leaving. So I'm really looking forward to this opportunity. You know, like I said, I'm a very humble person, and I couldn't do it without the support of my loved ones and the people in my circle. So that's a huge celebration and victory. Even if we get denied, it's still huge for me and huge for us. So thank you, everybody, for all you've done for Legacy, all the time, the sacrifice. It's not easy. I know it. So with that,
Lawrence, you ought to give yourself the accreditation for deliberating the concepts and the topics that you come on every day with, because honestly, without you, none of this would be possible, because it started with the seed. Whether that seed is a bad seed or a good seed, it still has to be put in the ground, be planted. And you plant yourself, because in the beginning, if you remember and recall, I took a photo of you at a table one time, and you said, at first words out of your mouth was, I'm gonna da 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 and this and that and you know, and that and this is gonna happen, and it
took a year and a half
time.
Later.
Right.
Yeah.
It took some progression and perseverance and a lot of pursuing to do it. But in the end, if you stick with it and you keep pursuing your dreams of whatever it is you want to do, I don't care if it's good or bad in whose eyes. But if you stick with it and you keep watering it and you keep feeding it, it's gonna produce. And that fruit that comes off, that other people can eat off of, is a satisfaction of a gratitude that you'll never, ever achieve without being that doer. So, you know, all the seeds out there that were planted in order for this to happen, it started with you, Lawrence. It started with
that.
You. So,
all right, you guys,
real-
I got about 3 seconds. Love you guys. Bless y'all. Enjoy your life. Happy Father's Day. Bye, y'all.
Later.
Bye, brother. I love you.
Love you, bro.